the Hagman and Hagman Report. Our guest this hour is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. Go to his website, FamilySecurityMatters.org. That's FamilySecurityMatters.org. And check out his books on Amazon, Blackout Wars, Apocalypse Unknown, Electric Armageddon, and more. And The Long Sunday, which talks about a nuclear EMP attack scenarios. And that's something that we are facing as a threat from this conflict in North Korea. Dr. Pry, I want to ask you this question coming out of the gate. The conflict between the U.S. and North Korea could lead to a war, a hard war between the U.S. and China or Russia. In my personal view, I see more economic sanctions and other things that these countries would do rather than engage in a full military battle with the United States. Do you think that that's accurate, that the threat of hard war would be off the table over North Korea, or do you believe that they would not hesitate to go to war with the U.S. over North Korea?
I think they would hesitate to go to war with the United States over North Korea, but I certainly don't think that they would resort to that they would use economic sanctions or economic leverage. Russia doesn't have economic leverage right. that it can use over the United States. China does. But I think there's a very good chance that they would go to war, that they would engage the United States, because it's possible that this gambit that they've set up has pre-planned for that contingency, that that's what they want to happen. The last thing the United States needs right now is to get involved in a World War III against China and Russia and North Korea, and it would probably involve Iran and Syria as well, who are allied, tapped allies of both Russia and China. Our economy is a wreck. Our military is hollow. We've never been in a weaker position to engage in a large-scale war. America needs peace right now. We need a time to rebuild our economy. We need a time to rebuild our military strength, so that we can deter these actors or win a conflict if we get involved with a conflict. I don't think we could win a war against all this combination of actors. North Korea is right in China's backyard, and it's virtually in Russia's backyard. We have to project power all the way across the Pacific. And unlike us, they're willing to resort to the use of weapons of mass destruction right from the get-go, including nuclear EMP attack, which could, at a blow, do exactly what Kim Jong-un has been threatening. It could destroy. You could, with an EMP attack, potentially destroy our aircraft carrier group. Or you could destroy this whole country with an EMP attack from one of its satellites or from an ICBM. And that would collapse our military capabilities there. We haven't defended our critical infrastructures against EMP or cyber warfare or sabotage. And, we've been talking about asymmetric warfare from the point of view of the largest kind of asymmetric warfare, the geostrategic kind, where North Korea is being used as a pawn in this global chess game by Russia and China. And when you think it through, it's really hard to see how they can lose. If it came to a hard war, I think they would win. If it comes to a limited war, it's hard to imagine a limited war where, let's say, they stay out of it, and we're preempting the North Korean nuclear programs. I think that North Korea would, at minimum, be able to do tremendous damage to South Korea and Japan, and probably to the United States, too. They'd be able to reach out and do some tremendous damage to the United States, too. And while we might win, quote-unquote, we might, be able to destroy the North Korean nuclear program, the price that would be paid for that, it would be a Pyrrhic victory. I think in the aftermath of that so-called victory, Japan and South Korea and the American people would regard the price of that victory as so unacceptably high that we would probably retreat into isolationism, and the South Koreans and Japanese would see Russia and China as as better protectors than the United States, and that their interests, their national security interests, would be better served by aligning themselves with Russia and China and becoming client states of these actors instead of relying on the United States. Their involvement with us having resulted in a terrible new North Korean war that caused damage to themselves. So I would see us losing in that scenario. Let's say there is no war at all, and it's negotiated, and we go to negotiations. And this could be the greatest defeat of all. You know, if the negotiations fail to disarm North Korea, and we continue this 20-25-year pattern of negotiating to no purpose, and the North Korean program, the nuclear program, continues to advance, you know, we're just at that point. The reason it's being taken so seriously, you know, is there's still the military possibility of disarming North Korea. They haven't got that many ICBMs yet. You know, it's a small number. They do have a lot of medium-range ballistic missiles, so we probably would not be able to disarm all of those. But the ICBMs, they could threaten our homeland directly, and they've only got the two satellites up. You know, so that we, even if those are nuclear armed, we could still take them out. But we're just at the threshold where if they get a little stronger, North Korea will become irreversible as a nuclear weapon state, and it'll be too late to try to reverse the fact of a nuclear armed North Korea by war. And then we'll have to try living with a nuclear armed North Korea. And that peace, that so-called peace, I think would be fatal to the geostrategic balance and world order that is built on American security guarantees, because they would no longer be credible. They would no longer be credible. You know, Japan and South Korea and our allies in the Philippines all understand that the United States could not rationally be willing to trade Los Angeles or San Francisco for Seoul or Tokyo. Certainly, we're not willing to trade losing 90% of our population to an EMP attack to uphold our national security guarantees to South Korea and Japan. So our security guarantees would no longer be, by cold calculation, militarily credible. And that would undo the alliance. That would undo the existing world order. And we would be standing at the threshold of a new world order, which would be dominated by Russia, China, North, and their client states, North Korea, Iran, and as Sun Tzu says, you know, the greatest victory, the best victory, is one where you do not have to fight a war. And that perhaps is the most likely outcome, where we basically do nothing, negotiations being doing nothing, and lose the opportunity to save this existing world order, to uphold security guarantees. And it would be a transition in world history as stark and as dangerous, I think, as the end of the Pax Romana, the fall of the Roman Empire that then introduced the new Dark Ages. That's what a change in world order means. It's not some hypothetical political science idea. It has real human and historic consequences, usually terrible consequences. EMP especially brings on the prospect of literally a new Dark Ages that turns out the lights in America or over the whole world if it becomes a hard war, and opens the door to the new barbarians, who are these totalitarian and authoritarian states, you know, represented by Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran, and the terrorists. And the terrorists. What a change from Francis Fukuyama's end of history, where we saw this road that was leading to the bright uplands of freedom for all humanity. And here, not that many years later, we find ourselves standing on the precipice of a new Dark Ages.
You're right. From Fukuyama's optimistic screed to where we're at right now, different. And it's rather humiliating to me as an American just to see where we're at. So just to be clear in my mind, and then I know, Joe, if you have a question, but just to be clear in my mind, the alternative to, well, okay, There's a chance we could work this out, but we're going to be on the losing end, essentially, of a geopolitical chess game to, because over North Korea, to the client, or to the states of, or nation states of Russia and China, ultimately. Alternatively, we could be facing a war, the war, conflict, whatever you want to call it, could very well be asymmetrically, tactically performed. And you're looking at an EMP cyber attack kind of thing, is what you're saying, if I'm hearing this correctly.
Yes, that's right. One of the other, let's talk now, we've been talking about asymmetrical warfare at the level of geostrategy. Let's talk about on the battlefield of asymmetric warfare, or the operational level, and that is this new way of warfare that the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, it's really all patterned after the Russians. You know, General Vladimir Slivchenko, who basically literally wrote the book called No Contact Wars. It's a military textbooks taught in the General Staff Academy, and all the military textbooks in China and Iran, and as practiced by North Korea, all mirror, all reflect Slivchenko's original idea. And it's a new way of warfare that they consider, and I think they're right, you know, the greatest revolution in military affairs in history. What do they mean by revolution in military affairs? So let's go back to our World War II analogy again. You know, when Nazi Germany came up with the Blitzkrieg strategy, very few people in the Western democracies understood this new way of war that involved the coordinated use of armor and air power and fast-moving infantry and moving artillery to restore movement to the battlefield so that you could win wars very quickly. And, you know, the Western democracies, for the most part, with the exception of a handful of people like Winston Churchill and Major General J.F.C. Fuller, who tried to warn the West, but they were not listened to, came up with this idea. Most of the general staffs in the West thought World War II would be fought the way World War I was, and that the dominant technologies were going to be barbed wire and the trench and the machine gun. And so they would be static wars, and the aggressor would be at a big disadvantage. Well, technology, the clever, brilliant, ingenious use of technology by the Germans on land and by the Japanese at sea by the introduction of aircraft carriers, which some of us also first saw, you know, but not enough to change the mind of the U.S. Navy or the British Admiralty, you know, gave the advantage to the aggressor, tremendous advantage to the aggressor, so that the Nazis and the Japanese came within one small step of winning World War II. But a series of miracles prevented that, fortunately. Now, this new way of warfare is called many things by many nations. Slivchenko calls it no-contact war. The Chinese call it total information warfare or all-out cyber warfare. Some people in the U.S. Army War College call it cyber-geddon. I call it blackout war, you know, because that's the essence of it. The idea is that you don't attack the other guy's military directly. You attack the technological Achilles heel of nations, which is the electric grid, because everything depends on electricity. We're electronic civilizations now, and if you can collapse the electric grid, you'll collapse all the life-sustaining critical infrastructures, transportation, communications, banking and finance, industry, even food and water depend directly or indirectly on electricity. So if you can collapse that electric grid, and cause these other critical infrastructures to crash, you will paralyze the military forces of the other side and win the war very decisively in a very short period of time, perhaps in 24 hours. That's why they consider it the greatest revolution in military affairs in history. That's why Slivchenko calls it no-contact wars, because you could defeat a military superpower like the United States that has so many technological advantages in its military forces. You could defeat them without even having to go to battle with our military. In effect, it renders armies and air forces and navies obsolete. And you don't have to be a great power to conduct this war. If you're a failed state like North Korea, you know, all you need is the ability to conduct a cyber war that could take down the electric grid, or the ability to introduce enough saboteurs to take down the electric grid, or just one atomic weapon so that you could do an nuclear EMP attack, which would take down the electric grid. And ideally, under the new way of warfare, envisions coordinated attacks by all of these means, using cyber and sabotage, non-nuclear radio frequency weapons, and nuclear EMP attack being the ultimate cyber weapon by their doctrine. All of this designed to collapse the electric grid and the critical infrastructures and bring the nation to its knees. And there's never been a time in history when a failed state like North Korea, or a failed state like Iran, or even non-state actors like ISIS and Al-Qaeda could destroy the most sophisticated civilizations on Earth, which they could by this means, this new way of warfare, which is sort of a super offensive war. You know, he who strikes first using these means has got a tremendous advantage over the other side, you know, because it's so hard to defend against it. And that's the
man. You make some good points. I don't mean to interrupt. I just want to kind of give you a heads up. We are going to bypass our bottom of the hour break because I don't want to interrupt. We don't want to interrupt your continuity of thought. And folks, our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, you know, there are people out there and people within our government who pay a lot of money to listen to this man's opinions and listen to him talk. Here he is giving you the information flat out tonight on our platform, and we are so thankful that he has given his gracious gift of time, so we're not going to sully up or mess up his continuity of thought any longer outside of my interruption with a bottom of the hour network break. Dr. Pry, we are just so thankful that you're giving this information, and please show folks, do yourself a favor, go to Amazon, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, Blackout Wars, Apocalypse Unknown, and others, and as well as Family Security Matters. We have to keep, we have to inform our neighbors, we have to inform our people, we have to inform our congresspeople. Dr. Pry, again, my apologies for the interruption, but I just want to make sure I notified you that we're just going to continue right forward, and, just to say thank you again, and I promise I won't, I won't interrupt you anymore.
Well, please feel free to. And thank you for having me. It's not a pleasant subject to discuss. And you and all of the people who are listening tonight, I'm so grateful that you are listening, willing to listen. You know, you on this network and our listeners are the new Minutemen in this 21st century age of cyber warfare. The first step toward defending ourselves and achieving victory over these adversaries is by understanding the threat. And everybody who comes to understand the threat becomes part of the solution. So you on this radio station and all of your listeners become part of the solution, even if in a small way, so that at least we are a democracy. And having this knowledge enables us collectively to hopefully make the right decisions and the right choices. And there are things people can do. You know, all of the solutions do not have to come out of Washington and should not come out of Washington. You know, the founders did not envision that Washington would run this country. You know, people who are constitutionalists and are familiar with our history know the way the founders envisioned this country is that most of governance was supposed to be done at the level of the states. And it has been my experience, and I have to admit that I'm a creature of Washington, but as a creature of Washington, I freely and gladly admit that the further away you get from Washington, the more common sense you find in governance. The closer you get to the people, the more effective and more commonsensical government is. As an example of this, when the EMP commission on which I served terminated in 2008, you know, it had made a list of over 100 recommendations to protect our electric grid and other critical infrastructures from the very threats that I am describing. Because it is possible to defend against them. And For 8 years, Washington did nothing. And in frustration, I took my task force, I talked to other members of Congress who shared my concerns, and they gave me permission to go to the states. And the first state we went to was Maine. There was a Democrat, a lady named Andrea Boland, who actually reached out to us and said, let's try to do this in the state of Maine. We went and spoke to the Maine state legislature. Nobody there had heard about EMP or even knew anything about it. And at first they thought we were crazy. You know, but my team had an opportunity to brief them and to explain the threats and the situation and what the solution was. It took only 6 months to get a bill passed through the state legislature, through the House unanimously, an overwhelming majority in the Senate. And the governor signed it into law in 6 months. We went from a state legislature that knew nothing about EMP to 6 months later having a bill to protect the Maine electric grid pass and be signed into law. And in 8 years, in contrast, Washington had done nothing for 8 years. Now, fortunately, Washington finally did do some big, important thing just last year. The last possible legislative minute in 2016, literally at the last minute, they finally passed the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act, you know, which is a best big step forward toward getting our grid protected. It's not going to solve the whole problem, but it's a really good and promising start. I just fear that I hope it's not too little too late. You know, our solutions and the pace at which we're moving to protect ourselves is certainly not keeping up with the threat. I mean, it's certainly not keeping up with the threat when tomorrow we are in such a crisis with North Korea that we have this unprecedented meeting of the entire U.S. Senate, the entire Senate in the White House to be briefed on the North Korean threat. So I don't know. I mean, if we ended up having a war with North Korea and they made an EMP attack this year, it would certainly be too late. You know, we need more time to get our country protected.
Do you see that? And I'm just curious. I think we might have had this discussion last time, and certainly I wouldn't hold you to any specific answer. But I was just really trying to run through some scenarios, and I talked with some others within the framework of DHS. And I'm just curious, how would you see? You got the meeting tomorrow, very critical. But let's say North Korea decides, okay, they're feeling froggy, they're going to leap. Would it be, in your estimation, based on your analysis, would it be the U.S. mainland? Would it be China? Would it be South Korea? And if it's the U.S. mainland, would it be from, I mean, what would it look like, I guess, if you would game this out?
I'm most concerned about their satellites. And I think it would be the U.S. mainland. And I think the North Korea would do a simultaneous strike against the United States, South Korea, and Japan. They'd use Nodongs against Japan and South Korea. That's their medium-range ballistic missile. And they'd use their satellites against us. And they'd probably try to launch, you know, their ICBMs and hope that a few of their ICBMs could reach the United States too. You know, possibly to blast cities in the old-fashioned way. But the satellites are what worry me most. They are on a south polar trajectory, and we don't know what's on those satellites, but it's possible that they've got a super EMP weapon on those satellites. Russian generals who were Russia's top experts in EMP demarched the EMP commission in 2004 to warn us that the design for their super EMP weapon had accidentally, quote-unquote, leaked to North Korea, and that in a few years, North Korea could build this and test it. And just like clockwork, just as the Russians predicted, and a few years later in 2006, the North Koreans conducted their first nuclear test. The world declared it a failure because it was only 1 to 3 kilotons. But that's very precisely the yield that a super EMP weapon would look like, because it's not designed to create a big explosion. It's designed to put out gamma rays, which is what causes the high-frequency EMP effect, the most damaging kind of EMP. The kind that can stop cars, make airplanes crash, take down SCADAs and destroy not only the electric grid, but all the critical infrastructures. Everything depends on that depends on electricity, including the personal computer on your desk. The these weapons are small. They're lightweight. They resemble a nuclear artillery, a neutron nuclear artillery shell, such as we deployed, so-called enhanced radiation warhead that the Carter administration had deployed to NATO. You know, they weigh less than 100 pounds, so they could easily fit on one of these satellites. And if I, so the North Koreans would, if they decide to go to war, Kim Jong-un is a huge gambler. You know, I don't think he would, I don't think he would hit lightly. I don't think he'd go for limited nuclear options or warning shots. I think he would roll the dice and he'd try to take everybody out. Because if there was a war, you know, he would assume, correctly, that we're going to try to kill him, and we're going to try to destroy his regime. We practice trying to take him out. You know, these exercises we just conducted in March, that was part of the scenario, to take out part the North Korean leadership, in addition to preempting, you know, their nuclear capabilities. So he would, you know, he'd be doing everything in his power to destroy us before we destroyed him. And that's why, there would be no second chance. He knows that, you know, we have so much power, he'd have no opportunity for striking second. He would try to and hope that the EMP first strike might so destabilize us that he would win. A super EMP weapon would take down not just the civilian critical infrastructures, but the fields are so powerful, you know, it could paralyze our retaliatory forces and our strategic command and control. It's the only realistic prospect he would have for achieving a victory in war. So I think that that's what it would probably look like. You know, it makes sense from a military standpoint, but also because Kim Jong-un is obviously a risk taker, and he would roll the dice. In addition to the EMP attack, as we have been discussing, there'd be cyber attacks. You know, North Korea has got more cyber warriors under arms than we do. You know, they've got a bigger cyber army than the United States does in cyber command. So they'd be using cyber attacks as well to go after our electric grid and do whatever damage they could to us and to our allies. And I have no doubt it's doubtful that North Korea's got North Korean saboteurs here in the United States. But, you know, they are allied with Iran. And they have relations with international terrorism. I would not be surprised. It would probably be part of their plan, you know, and certainly would be in Iran's interests to take us down as well. That has been a long-term geostrategic goal of theirs. So the sabotage parts of it, you know, you could expect terrorist cells that are already embedded in this country, at minimum the ones from Iran, but possibly also those from international terrorists, you know, to be activated in a coordinated way, you know, to go after key nodes in our electric grid and in our other critical infrastructures. It's very underreported in the press. I'm one of the few people who's actually written about it. But the attack on the Metcalf Transformer substation in California that happened in 2013, the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission had the U.S. Navy SEALs look at that, and the SEALs concluded that it was a really professional commando-style operation at the same level that the SEALs themselves would conduct. They judged that it was practice. It was practice. 2013, April 16th, 2013, for some larger, more ambitious attack on the U.S. electric grid that would happen in the future. And the perpetrators, you know, when the police arrived at Metcalf, they had shot up the transformers. They knew exactly where to shoot. They had gone into an underground tunnel and cut the cables. They knew exactly what to cut. And when the police arrived, you know, they arrived in less than a minute. You know, the guys were still there, and a minute later they disappeared, and we never found out who they were. Somehow they disappeared mysteriously into the night. But here's a clue. On April 16th, 2013, you know, we were in the middle of what was then the worst ever nuclear crisis with North Korea. And on that very day, that same day, North Korea's KMS-3 satellite, the first one they'd launched, passed over Washington, D.C., posing a threat, like they were practicing to attack the eastern grid, just when this attack by sabotage was happening on the western grid. So North Korea may already have practiced for this very scenario, you know, we're describing. But I think that's what it would look like from the North Korean, from the North Korean side.
Dr. Pry, just as you were explaining that, a few thoughts went through my mind. One, what would be the, would we be able to successfully launch a, we'll say, an EMP attack against North Korea? And would that be effective in disabling their military capabilities as far as launching missiles and whether it's the South Korea or an attempted strike on America?
We could launch an EMP attack. Perhaps not as good a one as the North Koreans could launch against us. You know, because during the Obama administration, and unfortunately during the Bush administration too, you know, we have followed this rule, you know, that we aren't building new nuclear weapons of new design. We never built super EMP weapons. You know, all we've got are the old Cold War style weapons. The designs are 30 to 40 years old. And the weapons themselves are not new. We've been patching them together, you know, for 30 to 40 years. But we could do an EMP attack, and it might be enough. It would be more effective than our cyber attacks. You know, and in fact, even the Obama administration, Department of Defense, you know, in testimony, open source testimony to Congress, and I was kind of astonished to see this, but they were talking about the same kind of new way of warfare that General Slupchenko was describing in his book, where we have talked about using against North Korea and potentially other adversaries a combination of nuclear MP and cyber attacks and physical sabotage to take down the other side to stop them from launching. Nuclear MP would give us the best chance of stopping their launches. So it's something we could do, but we'd have to strike first. We'd have to be the ones to make the strike first. While from a military standpoint, it certainly makes sense. You know, when I think about the attitude that exists in our military and our foreign policy establishments toward nuclear weapons use, though, let's not forget the people who are advising Trump right now, President Trump, are mostly Obama administration holdovers. You know, except for a handful of people that the president has appointed, you know, there are still 4,000 appointed people that have not been appointed by the Trump administration, and they are basically still Obama administration holdovers, 99% of them. You know, we've only got General Mattis, for example, in the whole Pentagon. The Secretary of Defense is a Trump appointee, but everybody else is from the Obama administration. Same thing in the Department of State. You know, we have one or two people appointed, and everybody else is from the Obama administration. All these other bureaucrats have a say or would advise the president. And if their advice wasn't listened to, they would be leaking to the Washington Post and the New York Times to stop a decision that they disagreed with. It would be very difficult, even though Trump is a brave guy, is a very brave guy, even he might find it a bridge too far to decide to launch a nuclear first strike against North Korea, even if it's an EMP first strike that doesn't blow up any cities or anything. You know, for an American president to do a gutsy thing like that, especially with all of the bureaucrats in the Pentagon, except possibly his own defense secretary, and all the bureaucrats in the State Department, except perhaps for the Secretary of Defense against him, that's a very gutsy thing. Hard to, you know, it would be a real profile in courage. But it might be necessary. You know, it might be, you know, the only hope we have under current circumstances if the balloon were to go up tomorrow.
Okay. Dr. Pry, what about, you know, we've seen this being used unsuccessfully in the Middle East. it destabilizes the nations, but a regime change. If we were to take out the leader of North Korea, would that make any difference whatsoever, or is the ideology so strong there that you would just have another type of Kim Jong-un?
Taking him out with plausible deniability on our part.
Yeah. I think North Korea is a different situation than was the situation in Iraq or Afghanistan. There really aren't any successors to Kim Jong-un. Their system is so focused on this one man. You know, North Korea masquerades as a Stalinist dictatorship, but it's really a theocracy that's dedicated to the worship of Kim Jong-un. And that's not a joke. You know, they attribute supernatural powers to him. We laugh about it. I mean, Kim Jong-un is described in their own press as golfing a perfect game, that he's invented the internet, or he's invented cyber warfare, or every successful nuclear test and successful missile launch has been because of the wisdom of Kim Jong-un. He's described as having various kinds of supernatural capabilities. In the press, he's described as appearing in public, and there's a halo around his head, literally a visible halo around his head. If you've seen imagery, movie reels of the funeral of his father, Kim Jong-il, it's really hard to believe. I mean, this monster, it's hard to believe it was an act. Millions of people in absolute hysterics over the passing of their great leader. And the succession in North Korea, in order to set up Kim Jong-un, it took a little time. He was in place. He was appointed. His father had made it clear that this guy was supposed to be his successor. And the secret police that surround him, thousands of them, to enforce himself as the successor, knew that he was the guy. If you were to suddenly take him out, I mean, Kim Jong-un killed his stepbrother in Malaysia, I think in part because he didn't want his stepbrother being used as a replacement. You know, you don't get to be the heir apparent to Kim Jong-un in North Korea and live. Heir apparents get bumped off. So there isn't any real successor to him. I mean, the short answer is, I think, would be an enormous internal crisis. While North Korea is, very formidable militarily, you know, it's a totalitarian militant state, I think in this respect it's extremely fragile. It would be the equivalent of, like, killing the Wicked Witch in The Wizard of Oz. You know, I think that it would be incredibly disruptive to their command and control and, I mean, under a benign and very hopeful scenario, maybe somebody with sanity would step in and take. Although that's probably not the likely scenario. More likely, the place would just fall apart into some kind of civil war. But I'd rather have the North Koreans killing each other than killing us.
And is that on the table? I mean, Dr. Pryde, is that on the table? Because we saw rumors, reports of SEAL Team 6 practicing, you know, all this other this stuff. Was that just for theater, or is that actually on the table? I mean, could this happen?
I think it is on the table. I don't think it's classified. When the press reports were describing the Eagle Foal 2017 exercises that transpired in March, I mean, that's one of the things that got Kim Jong-un. Well, he's always upset about these exercises. They're routine exercises that we have every year. But part of the exercise is to take out the North Korean political military leadership, to decapitate them, you know, to stop them from launching their nuclear weapons. And it's an open, it's not a secret. I mean, our Pentagon has admitted that that's part of the exercise scenario that we have practiced, and certainly it's one of the reasons Kim Jong-un is so in his paranoia. You know, he's already a psychopath, paranoid psychopath. Why he we dismiss it by calling it nuclear saber rattling. I don't think it's merely nuclear saber rattling. You know, these guys have been on a war footing, expecting an outbreak of a new Korean War or a new world war ever since the armistice. You know, the Korean War never ended for them. You know, we never had a peace treaty with them. The North has always considered itself to continually be in a state of war. And it reminds us of this by occasionally committing some act of military aggression against the South, or an act of terrorism internationally. Yes, that is on the table, and I it's not a secret.
Well, I'll tell you something. You know, if I was in the White House, aside from drinking gallons of Maalox or whatever stomach medication there might be, I'd be calling you up and saying, "Hey, man, hey, come on down handle this," because man, your analysis is measured and certainly you know the landscape.
And I don't mean to interrupt.
No,
but,
fine.
Dr. Pryor, do you find Donald Trump's lack of foreign policy experience in a problem when dealing with this situation?
I think it's a strength. I think it's a strength for him to come to it with fresh eyes. If we'd be in real trouble right now if Hillary Clinton had been elected president.
Boy, I was going to ask you that.
With all of her vast foreign policy experience, quote unquote, because when they talk about foreign policy experience, what that means is you think like the Washington establishment. Let's not forget, my friends, that the reason we're where we are is because the Washington establishment put us here. You know, this is a consequence of these professional State Department people who have been trained at Harvard, and they're just like Neville Chamberlain. You know, I wish they had read more history and read less international relations theory. That's where their heads are buried. This belief that you can negotiate your way out of anything, that we're so clever that we can convince the Chinese that it's their interests to do what we want them to do. The problems that we have right now is because our foreign policy establishment has got its head buried in the wrong place and has made mistakes over decades and hasn't learned anything. It hasn't learned anything from its mistakes. Let me give you an example. Look at the Clinton administration, the agreed framework under Bill Clinton. You know, that was negotiated for us by the Department of State, by the Clinton appointees. It was a State Department project. I was on the North Korea Advisory Group in Congress when that was going on. Jim Woolsey, who I had served under the CIA, you know, was still the CIA director. And, you know, in January 25th, I believe it was 1994, Woolsey testified in public to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that the intelligence community had judged that North Korea had the bomb. And for the first 6 months of the Clinton administration, there was a crisis. And because they thought they might have to go to war with North Korea to stop their nuclear program cold. But the hubris that Western democracies, that I explained earlier, asserted itself. And Gary Seymour, from Bill Clinton's National Security Staff, met with me and other members of the Congressional National Security Staff to tell us, peace in our time, peace in our time. They've come up with an agreed framework, so we won't have to go to war with North Korea. North Korea, if we give North Korea economic support and build additional nuclear reactors and give them free food and free oil, they've agreed to engage in negotiations that will eventually denuclearize them, so they won't have the bomb anymore. And Clinton claimed credit all through the 8 years of his administration that his agreed framework has succeeded and that we were on a pathway toward denuclearizing North Korea. But we on the North Korean advisory group thought that that wasn't true, that North Korea was lying, you know, that they continued to feverishly work on the bomb. They hadn't perfected an ICBM yet. That was the main thing. They were trying to work, they were trying to perfect the Taipo Dong 2 so they could have an ICBM that would reach the United States. And we tried to tell anybody in the press who would listen what the truth was, but the press wouldn't listen to us. Instead, they gave Clinton all this credit for denuclearizing North Korea and solving the problem of the nuclear North Korea. Well, look what happened. Where did that get us? You know, Gary Stamore was one of that negotiating team, and Wendy Sherman was the negotiating partner in the Department of State. And then, you know, we ended up with nuclear North Korea, clear as day, by the time of the Obama administration. Actually, by the time of the Bush administration, but it was clear as day.
That's right. And this was under Ash Carter. Right.
Right. And who did we send to negotiate the Iran nuclear deal? Who did we send? We sent Gary Seymour and Wendy Sherman to negotiate the Iran nuclear deal for us, even though these two had failed catastrophically and delivered us a nuclear North Korea. You know, this is the, you know, my point is that this is the foreign policy establishment. These are the experienced people in our foreign policy establishment. They have been a catastrophe for our national security, especially the State Department people. I'm not talking about the people in the Department of Defense or the intelligence community, but the State Department people, you know, who are the tip, usually is for us, is the tip of the spear. We always try negotiation and give the Department of State the opportunity, and these guys will insist that there is never any end to negotiation. There's always hope that the negotiation will succeed. And that's how we ended up with the nuclear North Korea. So I actually think that Trump's lack of experience, you know, because he hasn't been brainwashed by these State Department ideologues, you know, is actually a positive thing. That he'll hopefully bring common sense to it, the way the man in the street would. I think like William F. Buckley. I'd rather take the first 100 people. Let's not make it the New York City telephone book. Let's make it the, a telephone book from Tampa, Florida. You know, the first 100 people in a telephone book from Tampa, Florida, I'd put them in charge of our foreign policy, you know, instead of these guys who've been doing our foreign policy for the past 20 years and have created this disaster that's in front of them. You know, they read too little history. They live in a bubble, an academic bubble. Their views are dominated by arms control ideology and a belief system that comes basically from Harvard and Yale and Princeton, these universities that won't allow conservatives to speak on campus. You know, the people that come out of these institutions are convinced the United States is the reason we have all these problems in the world. And it's the United States that is the chief problem. And these are the kinds of people, you know, that have their PhDs from Harvard in international relations, that get the top jobs in the Department of State, and they regard America. They blame America first for everything. And that's why we have such a lousy foreign policy. So, well, I'm sorry for my long-winded answer.
No, that's good.
To wrap it up, no, I do not think that Trump's lack of foreign policy experience is a problem. I actually, again, think it's a potential asset because I hope he'll bring the kind of common sense to the problem that the average American would bring. You know, the foreign policy establishment, you know, has been a disaster. And if the much more experienced Hillary Clinton had won, we would have no hope. There'd just be no hope for us coming out of this successfully. You know, we'd probably end up in a war that we'd lose.
Exactly. And anything, in my view, by the way, that I think that that's spot on. And I think a lot of people, that's an area of contention, you know, among a lot of people or with a lot of people, but I think that's spot on. And I'm in agreement with you too. I would prefer to see 535 farmers, business owners, successful business owners and entrepreneurs running our country. than what we've got there. So right now, but it's interesting. You go point back to the agreed framework deals back in the 90s, early 90s. We were at the brink of war in 93, 94, if I'm not mistaken, as you had mentioned.
Yes,
and then we acquiesced
from January of 1994. For about 6 months after that period, the Clinton administration was seriously thinking then about a preemptive strike against North Korea. And some of the Clintonistas, even during after the agreed framework was exposed as completely bogus during the Bush administration, when North Korea was flight testing its Taipodong 2, and you know, when it was obvious, and they had done their nuclear tests, it was obvious that the agreed framework had not stopped them. Ash Carter and William Perry, who had been Secretary of Defense under Bill Clinton. Ash Carter, of course, was recently a Secretary of Defense under Barack Obama, but they chastised the Bush administration for failing to preempt North Korea. They were recommending in the Washington Post that that Bush should be blowing up and shooting down the North Korean missiles so that they would not be able to develop missiles. I find it interesting that that when Ash Carter did become Secretary of Defense, what happened to his good advice? I actually think he was right. You know, I do wish the Bush administration had done that and had followed that advice. But when he was Secretary of Defense under Barack Obama, we didn't hear a peep from him out of taking preemptive actions against North Korea.
And here we are.
Such is the wisdom of our professional foreign policy establishment and even our defense establishment, at least the Democrat-appointed part of our... now here we are.
Sorry to jump in there, Dr. Pry. We only just have a few minutes left. I want to make sure I ask you this: the agenda of the globalists, or the New World Order, if you want to term them that, have been to come against North Korea and Iran. And before 9/11, there was, you know, a list of seven countries that didn't have the central banks. And North Korea and Iran were two of the countries on the list. Libya and Syria were a few others. All those now have central banks, except for North Korea and Iran. We know that this has been part of their...
If you want to describe that as motive, but go ahead.
Yeah, we know that this has been part of their plan and agenda for a long time, and that they plan on bringing this about. Do you see any way that this scenario can end diplomatically, with an agreement, maybe even between China and North Korea? Or do you think that the globalist agenda of taking over North Korea and Iran will come to fruition one way or the other?
Oh, I think this is likely to end with a negotiated agreement, but not a solution. I think this is... I don't think the United States will have the fortitude in the end to do a preemptive strike against North Korea. I think there's going to be enormous pressure from the Department of State and from the media to negotiate with the North Koreans. We're on that pathway now, you know, because Trump has gotten big points. One of the few things wherein he has been praised is that he's got the Chinese to appear like they're willing to find a negotiated solution. I'm a skeptic. I'm on a minority view here, but I don't trust the Chinese, as I've explained. I think that this has been a game the Chinese have been playing for 20 years, pretending that they're going to find a negotiated solution. So I think that what they're going to do is try to turn Trump away from a military solution toward a negotiated solution. And we'll just see history repeat itself. The Chinese will pocket some huge concessions for being so helpful, and North Korea will not be stopped. China will and Russia will continue to help them evolve forward their nuclear threat, and we will have lost the time and opportunity to have stopped North Korea. And then, the peace that follows, we and our allies, in the face of a North Korea that can reach out and strike the United States with ICBMs, with EMP, strike our allies in South Korea and Japan, will reevaluate you know, the nature of our security agreements and say, you know, gee, is America's security guarantees to us really credible in this new world where North Korea can strike the United States? Do I really want to keep depending on the North on America since they failed to stop North Korea from becoming a nuclear power, despite the fact that Bill Clinton promised us years ago that he had done that and they'd failed? Maybe it's time for me to get closer to China, get closer to Russia, because those guys seem to be smarter. They seem to understand power politics smarter. And maybe we're on the wrong side of history here. I think that's what's the likely outcome, you know, where the bad guys, there will be a negotiation, but not a solution. The solution will be one that's favorable from the block of the totalitarian and authoritarian powers and not favorable to freedom. And so we will face the prospect of the bad guys winning the new Cold War without fighting, you know, by this chess game in which North Korea has been a major and important piece. But it doesn't have to be this way. You know, there are things we can do, you know, before we close, because I don't want this to end on a completely negative and defeatist note, but there are obvious things that we can do. You know, we could shoot down those satellites. You know, we could shoot down, I wouldn't advocate blowing the missiles up in the pads, but we could shoot down the North Korean missiles with Aegis cruisers when they're launched. That way Kim Jong-un doesn't lose face and he's not forced into attacking South Korea or anything. You know, as long as his people don't see that their missiles are being shot down in a very visible public way, you know, only he and a handful of his general staff would know that we were doing it. In the meantime, we should...
Wow. Yes. I don't mean to interrupt, but we've reached the absolute end of our time, taking us right to the very
end.
But I'll tell you something, Dr. Pry. You've got the solutions are out there, and I just want everyone to know that this doesn't have to be a bummer. Like you said, FamilySecurityMatters.org, and your books as well will help people, correct?
Yes, not just to know what Washington should be doing, but what we should be doing for our families, for our communities, and in our states. You know, we
All
don't
right.
have to wait and shouldn't be waiting for Washington to solve the problem of the threat to our country. You know, we should take our fate in our own hands and do what's necessary to survive.
And we're going to urge everyone in our listening audience or viewing audience to certainly spread your information around, and because you've got some great analysis, great answers. Yeah, and I'm sorry, man, we're already into the break. God bless you, my friend. Thank you.
And thank you all and your audience for becoming a part of the solution.
Thank you, sir. All right. Brother, until we talk again, God bless you.
We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere.
Worldwide demand is making coconuts one of the highest-yielding cash crops available today. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and many high-net-worth individuals have invested billions of dollars into coconuts for strong growth and solid long-term income. Yields could be as high as 18% or more per year. Capital appreciation and exceptional income for up to 60 long years would be an absolutely brilliant investment to pass on to future generations. Diversify wisely with direct ownership of fully managed coconuts on prime farmland close to the beautiful Costa Rican border. For more information, qualified accredited investors should go to profitsincoconuts.com or phone 855-888-6288. That's 855-888-6288. This announcement does not constitute an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offer made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288 or visit profitsincoconuts.com. Profitsincoconuts.com.
You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.